This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Raleigh bartender Doc Henley woke up one morning with a mysterious phrase lodged in his head. He scrambled for the pad he keeps by his bed and he wrote down the words, wine to water. He wasn't sure what to make of it, but soon he would turn those words into an organization that would help thirsty people around the world. What Doc found out was that there were people who die because they don't have safe drinking water. First he got angry, and then he got busy. He held some wine tastings to raise money to travel to Darfur. He then began to learn how to provide clean drinking water to people who rarely get it. Doc started a nonprofit called Wine to Water, and through that group he helps people in 12 countries get their own water so they don't have to rely on handouts from well-meaning Westerners. He wrote a book about the journey. It's called Wine to Water, A Bartender's Quest to Bring Clean Water to the World, and Doc Henley joins us now. Welcome back, Doc. Good to talk with you.
Hey, thanks so much for having me back on.
Well, when we first had you on, you were a finalist for CNN's Hero of the Year. You had already begun the project. What effect did the media attention have?
Oh, it was absolutely huge for us. You know, we were struggling, you know, the couple years before that to really even make ends meet and get our voice heard of what we were trying to do to fight this world water crisis. And then after that exposure, within a month, we were able to bring in the same amount of funding that took us 12 months previous to bring in. But even more importantly than the funding is it gave us a voice, and people began to listen to the things that we were saying about what was going on in the world, and also the way that we felt like is the most important way to address this water crisis. And so people began to actually listen, and that really actually is, I feel like, more valuable than the funding that began to come in.
Well, and talk about that way. Talk about what it is you do.
What's really important about our work is, yes, we are addressing the world's water crisis globally, but we do it a little bit different, and the fact that we think that what's the point in helping someone? What's the point in going and drilling a well? What's the point in giving someone something if you're not going to enable the people there locally to be involved in their own solution? In fact, I think sometimes we make things worse if we are giving a handout of something free to someone and not involving them in their own solution. So the way we work is through all locals on the ground in every country that we're working in. We use local people, local laborers, and then even just as important, we use local materials to do this work in every place that we can. So in Cambodia, we got a local team of Cambodians that are going around and drilling hundreds of wells all over rural parts of Cambodia. And in the beginning, they were using parts from made in India to build these wells. And very quickly after, we had them switch over and transition and build their own pumps made out of parts right there made in the market, so supporting the local economy. If it breaks down, which all wells break, very quickly they can go right to the market and get the part they need instead of waiting on some very expensive part to be shipped in from India, you know. So that's kind of the concept. We just, you know, the age-old saying, teach a man to fish kind of thing, you know.
Yeah, well, you know, it almost sounds kind of easy, too easy. It's like, well, let's just drill some wells if you're thirsty. and so when you got started, you say, you know, you didn't know what you were doing. What was the biggest challenge for you in getting this work done?
Well, the biggest challenge in the beginning was, there was actually quite a few of them, because the first place that I worked was an area called Darfur in the western region of Sudan. And so not only did I have going against me the fact that I had no idea what I was doing, but also in Darfur there's a genocide going on, quite a bit of insecurity. The conditions of just working in Darfur are pretty horrible. So I had a lot of things going against me there in the beginning. But I think it was important that I went over completely oblivious. I didn't have an engineering degree. I had never had any type of formal training, because the fixes that I would look at would be the most simple ones. And so I began looking at, well, why don't we have a team of locals that already know the language, that already know how to work with these people? Why don't we have them do the work, and I'll travel around with them? So it was very organic how the whole concept for that type of work came about.
And you open your book, Wine to Water, with a harrowing experience in Darfur. You end up in a place that, of course, had the greatest need, and that was the place where the NGOs wouldn't go because of the war. And there you are in your Jeep called Buffalo.
That's right, yeah. We decided not too long after landing on the ground in Darfur to work in these areas that I would soon find out, I didn't even know they existed, but they were called United Nations no-go zones. And basically, there were areas that were held on by the rebel groups that were fighting against the government, saying, we're sick of you coming in and destroying and raping our women and children. And so they decided to fight back, and they controlled these areas. And because of that, though, there was constant conflict that was going on throughout these regions. And so a lot of the organizations, even the United Nations workers, wouldn't go there because of that. But the thing is there were villages there. There were people there that needed help, and water was their most desperate need. And so that's where we decided to start our work there in Darfur.
And then describe that for us, because you had been warned that you are about to drive into an area where there might be government troops, and this would be a pretty dangerous place for you.
Yeah, the one of the worst incidents that happened came, I was leaving one of the areas, one of the UN no-go zones called Jebel Mara, and I was just assessing an area that had a cholera outbreak, and we're bringing some chlorine tablets to the region. And I was coming back from that area, and there's a village on the way back to my kind of base area where I was living at the time that was normally a ghost town that had been destroyed a long time ago, and I saw people there, and I wasn't used to seeing people there. And then I got closer and realized that there were government troops and Janjaweed mixed in together, and before I could even really have time to think, I noticed that there were some men hidden on either side of the road ready to what I was getting ready to find out, ready to ambush my convoy, and so I had to make a choice. Am I going to stop and try to reason with these guys, or am I going to just step on the gas and go? And my gut kind of made the decision, and I hit the gas. And right when I did, that first guy shot his AK-47, and I think the timing was perfect, because right when I stepped on the gas, it was just enough to set him off a little bit, and so I didn't get hit with that first bullet. And then the rest of the guys, they began opening fire on my vehicle and shooting out my windows. And it was a bit of an exciting experience.
You all made it through. Your guide let you know that was kind of a dumb thing to do, but y'all made it. And here's something and then you assess after you're finally in the clear and you take a look at the damage that's been done to your vehicle, and it's a mess, and you're wondering how you got through it. And then you notice that there was a bullet that just somehow veered. It would have hit the back of your head, but didn't. And then you write, maybe my crazy ass driving threw it off, maybe something else. What else? What else do you think?
Well, I've always felt like, I guess since the last few years doing this work, there's been a lot of situations where I maybe shouldn't have come out on top. I maybe shouldn't have made it through it. And when I looked at that box and started tracing the line of that bullet and how it was coming right in my head, and then just mistakenly or somehow it just took a turn, for me personally, I do feel like that this is the work that I am, I guess you could say, maybe called to do, or feel like this is the work that I'm supposed to be doing. And a lot of the things that pulls me through this work, especially when it's difficult times like that, I rely on my faith. And that's something that personally pulls me through these situations. I really feel like that day, me, in my own opinion, that was God watching out for me and had of it his hand on me. But also, I left it open in the book, because I don't force my views on anyone.
But you do feel somehow mysteriously guided, and it goes right back to the beginning when you woke up in the middle of the night with those words in your head. Take us back to that moment.
Yes, very, very much so. It goes right along the same concept. I don't understand why I woke up the night and had those words in my head. And to be honest with you, it was really strange that it happened to be, I talk about growing up in a home where my father was a pastor. It happened to be my favorite story in the Bible that all of a sudden these words are flipped around with. So it was kind of, it made me think on a couple different levels. But the reason why I love that story so much is because it proved that this Jesus character was probably a lot cooler than what I had been taught about as a young guy, that he's going to make all that wine for a wedding party so that the party wouldn't end. And I'm sitting there looking at these words on the page that are backwards. And hold on one second. I'm looking at these words on a page, and I'm like, that's my favorite story backwards. That made me really perk up and want to pay attention to what it was that was on my on the page in front of me. So,
though, given the trajectory of your life at the moment, the fact that the party story in the gospel was your favorite shouldn't have surprised anybody. You were kind of on the road to nowhere when this all came about, weren't you?
I definitely was. I guess you could say that my whole life at the time had become about me. It had become about the party that night, what I was doing for a late night after the bar shut down, whatever. It all became about myself, and And after that night, it became so important to me, not just because of the water crisis, because I really did become passionate about you know, fighting that crisis, but it gave me something to put my energy towards that was bigger than me for once, you know. So that was a big part of it.
So you pulled out of that. You got busy. You learned as you went. You end up in these war zones, and people are teaching you essentially the engineering and the techniques for developing wells. Is it the same in each place? Do you have to learn kind of new techniques? Do you face different problems in every place you go? Because now you're in 12 countries.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal question, and actually, it's completely different in every country, or it should be. The problem is there's a lot of folks out there, or groups or organizations, that feel like that one solution is going to work for all of them. And so they have this great idea that we work in an area that has consistent access to power, so they use these certain type of pumps, or an area that's consistently access to sun, so they use solar. And there's so many people that aren't willing to listen to the locals and what they think is going to be the best solution. And that's all I've ever done since the beginning, because I didn't know what I was doing. So that was the option I had. Well, let's just listen to the local people and what they think is best. And in every country, it's a little bit different. The filters that we use, like in Uganda, we use these biosand filters that are big, huge hunks of cement and concrete that are made out of local materials. They filter out over 90% of bacteria. And what's really important is that you can take water from a standing river source or wherever and pour it in, and it retains the same flavor as it did before. Because if we use the same type of filter that we use in Haiti, which is a ceramic filter that filters out 99.9 to the fifth power contaminants, it makes that water crystal clear and to what we here in the West would think is amazing tasting water. But you can't get Ugandans to drink that because they don't think it tastes good. Mm. So there's all these little things you run in when you start listening to the local people, and you can clean their water all day long, but if it doesn't, you know, for example, in Uganda, if it doesn't taste the way that they expect it to, they're not going to drink it. And so we only know these things, though, by just getting on the ground and spending time with them and listening to them and what they think their needs are.
Now, you mentioned Haiti. You went there after the earthquake. What were the unique challenges there?
Haiti was a rough spot for me because after leaving Darfur had a huge effect on me and my life, and it was very difficult for me to get over a lot of the things that I'd seen and experienced there. And then I never thought I would see anything that would affect me the same way. And then I get into Haiti right after the earthquake, and I was shocked again that, wow, I didn't think I would ever see anything as bad as Darfur. And this is different. It wasn't a conflict. It wasn't brought on by man. But here's a disaster where I saw things I never expected to see again and didn't really count on. And so it was very difficult for me emotionally to work through a lot of those times and to keep going back and forth that first year in 2010. But I really, it's one of my favorite projects now, so I'm glad I was able to, you know, kind of push through. We began bringing these filters from the Dominican Republic just after the earthquake. We're starting bringing these ceramic filters made right there on the island by this awesome lady who is a ceramics artist and expert. Her name's Lisa Ballantyne. And so we're shipping like 2,000 filters over the border right after the earthquake. And then I asked Lisa, I'm like, you know, would you mind helping us build our own factory right in Haiti and partnering with us to have this Haitian-run factory where they're making their own water filters out of their own local materials, because that's kind of the goal that we try to do in every country. And she was awesome. She agreed to help us make our own equipment and teach and train the local Haitians how to run their own factory. And so we, in November of that same year, we opened the factory's doors, and we're at about half capacity right now. We're building about, I'd say, 600-700 filters every single month, which reach about 5 to 10 people per filter. It's you give one per family. So that's crazy. I mean, we're reaching sometimes over 5,000 people every single month, which is it's one of my favorite programs, and it's all Haitians that are running it. So.
But before you were able to do that, crossing that border from the Dominican Republic into Haiti was kind of a problem, particularly once the border guards figured out how to make a living at it.
That's very true. But my first few months of bringing in equipment and supplies was easy. You know, there was such a disaster that the government had kind of shut down a little bit, so I could get across the border back and forth easy, no problem. And then one day I get a phone call. I'm back here in the States, and Lisa's like, man, we got one more shipment of materials to get so we can finish this factory and get these guys working, but we can't. They won't let us cross the border. They're asking for thousands of dollars in quote-unquote taxes that they're saying. And then I did some research, found out that we had all the paperwork that we needed to get across as a you know, local NGO. They just wanted money. So I flew down there right away, and I was kind of real, you know, kind of cocky, like, I'll get that truck across the border, you know. And so I hopped in the truck, got there, and I ran into the same issue. They refused to let me get across, no matter how much I argued or whatever. And so I just backed up and just kept heading south on the island. There was a guy that I had done some work with before that had told me that he had brought some materials over on a fishing boat from in this little fishing village down in the south of Dominican Republic. So I decided to head down south and load our material on a probably 200-year-old big old fishing boat. And through the night, we sailed to the beach right next to where the factory was. And it was a bit of an adventure, but we got it across. We finished the factory and didn't have to worry about any of the corruption. I guess we do that a bit. We try to fly under the radar a little bit sometimes so that the money's not going to the people that don't need it, for sure.
You know, as I read your book and learn more about your story, there are three kinds of challenges that occurred to me. They're kind of the natural disasters, things that you just have to kind of, you know, grit it out and figure out the problem. Then there are some other adventures like that, a leaky boat, and how are we going to get across, and aren't we facing down your fears that way? But then there's this other challenge. There's the human corruption, the Janjaweed and the Darfur, or the Sudanese government destroying their people, filling wells with the bodies of children, corrupt border officials profiting on a natural disaster. And I'm wondering if that takes a kind of toll on you, if there comes a point where you say to yourself, hey, man, this is a world not worth saving.
That really, it really, really does. Because in my mind, I want to think that everybody deep down has got something inside them that's wanting to help other people and be, you know, and serve humanity or whatever. But then when you see things like that, when you realize that there's people in Darfur that are using water as a weapon, and that they're, you know, they're killing and raping the women and children all over to try and, you know, ethnically cleanse the area. And then you got corrupt border officials who are using the efforts of other nonprofits that are trying to save lives to get themselves rich. And you run into these things over and over again, and sometimes it really put you down, because you want to, I want to have the you know, humanity held up on a pedestal, and that's not the reality that we run into. And so I think sometimes I just kind of have to swallow my breath and just get, you know, just deal with it. And I do in every situation try to go around it and fly under the radar and not have to even go through the red tape that a lot of folks, you know, end up having to go through. And being a small grassroots organization, we're able to do that. But it does. That's one of the hard things when I come home from an area that is hard to deal with, is that it's just not as it doesn't work out. It's not as easy, I feel like, as it should be. Why aren't more people throughout the world, you know, trying to be a part of these kind of solutions and helping save the lives of their own people? Why would there be this group called the Janjaweed that's going around and mowing down people just simply because of their ethnicity? Like, why does that happen? And I guess no matter how many nights I stay awake thinking about that and you know, trying to figure it out, I just have to accept it and keep pushing through, you know.
Apparently you're pushing through. I've only got about 30 seconds left, but do you have plans for a future, another project in the works, or are you going to stick with this one for a while?
I think, no, right now my main goal is to continue growing this organization exponentially. I hope by 2014, I'd set a goal a while back, within 5 years, this was back in 2009, to have reached 1 million people for clean water. And I'm hoping with the help of the book and with some exposure that we're able to continue growing the organization and be able to reach that goal of 1 million people by 2014.
Good luck, Doc. Hope you do it. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me again.
Doc Henley, founder and president of the nonprofit organization Wine to Water. The new book, Wine to Water, A Bartender's Quest to Bring Clean Water to the World. Learn more about it at winetowater.org. Just ahead, fantasy writer James Maxey tells us what love's got to do with superheroes. On the State of Things, stay tuned.